Welcome to Strong Tower Radio Today. The views and opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect the views of Strong Tower Radio, West Central Michigan Media Ministries, or its employees.
Hello and welcome to Strong Tower Radio's Good Growing with the Garden Guy. I am your host, Tom Measure, and our subject matter expert is Gary Heilig. Welcome back, Gary.
Happy to be here.
And my sister, Sue, is joining us for the ride.
Of course. I always enjoy it.
All right. Sue, would you lead us with a word of prayer?
Certainly. Heavenly Father, thank you for all the growing things you've created to teach us and to let us learn and to sustain our sense of wonder. And now as we start thinking about beginning to gear up for the growing season, help us to learn more, make good choices, and have a successful growing season. In Jesus' name, amen.
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 Well, Gary, it looks like you're going to move into that area of that controversial area of GMOs, genetically modified foods.
Well, actually, GMO stands for genetically modified organism.
Organism.
And we're specifically talking about food because they do that to other things too besides plants. And so the quiz starts out with, what does genetically modified mean? And this will be multiple choice. A, plants grown with fertilizer. B, plants crossed by traditional breeding. C, plants whose DNA has been changed using biotechnology. Or D, plants grown indoors.
I'm going to say DNA has been changed.
I'm going to, C. C, plants whose DNA has been changed.
That's right. And we'll talk a little bit more about that because it's basically genes that are moved around. Number two, which of the following is a common reason why crops are genetically modified? Now, I want to point out something. We've been genetically modifying crops since the beginning of agriculture. What's changed is the way it's done, and that's we'll talk about that as we go along. So, the question was, which of the following is a common reason why crops are genetically modified? A, to change their color. B, to improve pest resistance. C, to reduce water content. D, to shorten the roots.
Well, I don't know why you'd want to do the last two. And you didn't have to extend shelf life as one of your choices, so I guess I'll go with warding off pests.
That would be right. Yeah, and there are other reasons. And like in traditional breeding, when I first grew up, if you looked at a wheat field, the wheat would stand almost to your hips. But now if you look at the modern wheat that we have, the straw part of the wheat is about a foot long.
Mm-hmm. I've noticed that.
And so they use traditional breeding for most of that. I don't know if they did. I don't think they've done any genetically modified wheat to make it shorter. But you can do that with traditional methods. And so,
did they do that to protect it from being like windblown where it flattened the crop?
Well, strong winds can break the stems on long wheat. But also, it by doing that in terms of keeping it short, it concentrated the energy into producing what they actually want, which is the wheat itself. But the shortening also helped so that the wheat wouldn't fall over because it made it much more difficult to harvest it mechanically when it's laying down. Okay, number three, which crop was among the first widely grown genetically modified crops? Was it A, wheat, B, rice, C, corn, or D, lettuce?
I bet it's corn. You see all those signs out there about this company and that company and where the seed came from and all that. So I bet corn.
Corn is big business.
Yeah, it is corn. And the fourth question is kind of a follow-up. What is BT corn engineered to produce? That's a genetically modified corn.
That's for pasture.
And the answer is for A, extra vitamins, B, a protein toxic to certain insect pests, C, more sugar, D, herbicides.
Isn't BT that thing they put, you can dust under your plants when, like, say, the cabbage butterflies are there, and it makes their larva, like, grow two heads or something like that?
Yeah, it's Bacillus thuringiensis, and it comes in a lot of names like dipel, thuricide, impede. And what the creature does is that the bacteria makes an endotoxin, which is a protein, and they stop feeding. And what they did is they took the gene for this endotoxin, because BT is found in the soil, and they were able to put that gene into corn so that the corn would make it. And then when the insect feeds on it, just like when you sprayed your plant, only the BT is on the inside now, and the insect eats it, and they die. It is absolutely harmless to people, so it doesn't have any effect on us at all. Next one, number five. Which trait helps products survive herbicide or herbicide applications, whichever way you want to say it? Is it A, drought tolerance, B, salt tolerance, C, herbicide resistance, D, frost tolerance?
I would say herbicide.
Surely it's the herbicide resistance.
Right. Mm-hmm. And you probably heard of Roundup Ready soybeans, and basically they've engineered it so that you can spray Roundup over the top of the plants. It'll kill the weeds, but it won't harm the soybeans or whatever it is. I think they have Roundup Ready corn, too. All right, number six. Which of the following is a potential benefit of genetically modified crops? Is it guaranteed higher prices? Or is it reduced need for chemical insecticides? C, elimination of all pests. D, no environmental impact.
Well, it'd be great to have the last three, but I think that it seems like I've understood it in some ways. Farming isn't how much you get for your crop, but how much less that you spend to grow it, and that's where your profit is. So
that's right.
I would go for B, because then I, you know, a ton of insecticides to spray.
That's correct. That was your choice going to be, Tom?
Yep.
Okay. Number seven, golden rice was developed mainly to address, which was a failure, by the way, mainly to address a deficiency in which nutrient? Was it iron, protein, zinc, or vitamin A?
I never even heard of this golden rice, so when you said it was a failure, I was like, oh, wow, that's why we haven't heard of it.
It was the kind of a failure. It was developed to help treat eye illness and possible blindness in Africa.
Mm.
Oh, so vitamin A, like carrots.
That's right, vitamin A. That's why they erased the golden rice. Was developed to help with that problem. And all they did is took the gene from another plant, vegetable, might have been carrot, I don't know, that told the plant to make vitamin A, and they simply put it in a rice plant. So it produced a rice plant that would produce rice that had vitamin A in it.
So why did it fail?
People didn't want it. Part of it might have been that they were afraid of the genetically modified stuff, because people tell rumors and stuff about what they're actually doing, because in the past, Western countries did experiment on underprivileged countries without telling them. So that's one of the things that may have had something to do with it. Another thing is,
despicable.
If you expect rice to be a certain color and it's not, so for instance, if you saw a, well, I'll give you an example, orange tomatoes. I grew up watching, growing tomatoes that were only red, and I had a real hard time with orange tomatoes and yellow tomatoes because they just weren't appetizing to me. I knew there were tomatoes in my mind. I knew they would be all right in taste, and I did try some, but the color just wasn't attractive to me, and that might have been part of it, too, for them. That, hey, what's with this golden rice? Rice is supposed to be white. Something's wrong here. But it didn't do very well. Okay, next question. 8. What organization evaluates the safety of genetically modified foods in the U.S.? Is it the EPA only? The USDA only? The CDC, which is Center for Disease Control? Or is it FDA, USDA, and EPA combined?
Well, I think it's the combined thing because we know that the FDA certainly is the Food and Drug Administration. They're having their bailiwick as the food. And the USDA, when I worked in research, they were always poking their nose in there. We didn't deal much with the EPA, but that's environmental. So I say the combined thing.
What do you say, Tom?
I think that's a reasonable choice.
And that is correct. Number 9, how are genetically modified crops different from traditionally bred crops? A, they grow faster. B, they cannot cross with other plants. C, specific genes can be added directly even from other species. D, they never mutate.
You know, that's interesting. Mm. I definitely see, but D is kind of an interesting because when you have hybrid plants, they mutate.
Don't stay true to type like an heirloom.
Yeah.
Or heritage variety.
So
I remember
Tom
seeing a program
C.
that. Yeah, I'm
Which
going
with.
Going
with
I'm going with that. Yeah, I'm with the C thing there.
That's right. That's the right one.
I saw a program where they were trying to develop spider silk because it's so useful. They could do a whole lot with spider silk because it's stronger than steel for its side, and yet it's elastic, and they wanted to make it. So they've tried all sorts of things. So the last thing I heard was that they were making they were breeding or adding, you know, genetically modifying transgenic sheep and goats, and using the milk, they would produce the protein that is the spider silk, and extracting it from the milk and trying to use it. So, yeah, I would say definitely something that they're adding.
Yeah, it's gene-specific. Okay, number 10, which concern is sometimes raised about GM crops? A, they spoil faster. B, development of herbicide-resistant weeds. C, they cannot grow in soil. D, they are always toxic to insects.
Oh, I think the development of the herbicide-resistant weeds one is what I've heard most about.
They're worried, especially if the weed is related to the crop. They're worried about genes jumping from one to the other. 11. Are GM foods currently required to be labeled in the U.S.? A, no labeling is allowed. B, only if they are organic. C, yes, through bioengineered food disclosure rules. Or D, only for corn products.
Well, it can't be the labeling in organic means that you aren't meddling with it. So, and we know that they're doing stuff more than corn, so I'm going to go with the bioengineered food disclosure rules. Aren't those, seems like, Gary, I've heard, if you pick up an apple and it's got that little sticker on it with a number, that sometimes the number tells you things about whether it's genetically modified or not. Is that true?
Not that I'm aware of, but they do have to disclose that it's genetically modified. A lot of times, for instance, if you buy a product that's made with GM treated corn, it has to say it on the label that it's made with genetically modified corn. Numbers usually indicate they're usually for identifier for certain varieties so that you can be charged the proper amount of money.
I got a question.
There are some genetically modified apples that have been worked on. Specifically, if you are familiar with Cortland apple, if you slice a Cortland apple and you slice a Golden Delicious apple and let them sit out, the Golden Delicious will oxidize and the flesh will turn brown. But the Cortland stays white. And the reason for that is there's a gene that prevents oxidation. So they've taken that gene from one apple and they've introduced it into other apples so that those apples will act like the Cortland. But it's a gene from one apple species into another apple species. Or I should say cultivar, not species. And so from that standpoint, it's harmless because that's a gene that's already in apples. And most people would like the fact that their apple's not going to turn brown when they cut it. Because some turn brown really quickly. And I've showed you on some of my videos when I was doing apple tasting, some of the apples would sit and they wouldn't oxidize very easily. And that was a natural aspect of their breeding. If they can breed that into a plant naturally, they'll do it. But it's much easier to just select the gene and put it in the plant.
Has the rules...
I'm looking forward to more taste testing videos. You haven't done any for a while.
I've got to find apples to do it with. We are almost done. Let's go finish up the last two. Which method is commonly used to insert new genes into plants? A, freezing. B, soil injection. C, using bacteria or gene guns. D, grafting.
I would say gene guns.
Yep, gene guns.
Yeah, I would go with that. Freezing doesn't seem... I don't know what that would do with it.
No. Okay, last one. What is the scientific consensus on approved GM foods? A, that they're all harmful. B, they cause allergies in everyone. C, they are untested. D, they are safe to eat as conventional foods.
I'd say untested.
It better be D.
But I think it's untested.
Yeah, it is D. Like I said, a genetically modified plant is one that they've just moved a gene from one plant to another. And many times they are genes from within the species itself or within the crop itself. But they are playing around with other things, and we'll talk about that in the next segment.
Just to have a question before we go to the break is, has the legislation changed or has regarding genetically modified organisms?
Well, I can't tell you what laws are being proposed. They do, like I said, they do have labeling stuff, and I only deal with plants. So what they might be doing with animals is a totally different thing. Because I know, for instance, one of the earlier experiments they did was they introduced a gene that allowed a fish to fluoresce under certain light. In other words, you shine a light on it like a black light, and it would shine. And so they were just showing that they could move these genes from one species to another. But as far as any laws on that, I'm not sure. Usually laws are behind what the scientific advances are. Because when you really think about it, if you can move genes from one species to another safely, if you, say, pass the gene on for large size to an animal that was normally small, you might get a monster-sized animal. Because hybrid animals generally are larger than either of the parents anyway. But when they start mixing species and stuff, the government will definitely get involved with that.
Well, this is a good time to take a break, and you're listening to Good Growing with the Garden Guy with Gary Heilig, Tom Majeure, and Sue Majeure. We'll be right back after this break.
Many people make New Year's resolutions about things to improve their physical health. Eat more vegetables, start exercising, stop smoking, etc. If followed through, such changes have the power to literally add years to your life. But have you ever considered making spiritual resolutions too? Good spiritual habits like regular time in prayer, faithful church attendance, and daily Bible study can not only add quality to your life right now, but most importantly can establish a faith in Christ that will extend your life into eternity. If you want to turn over a new spiritual leaf in the coming year, why not commit to studying the Bible? Visit BibleStudyOffer.com and sign up for your free lessons today. You can receive lessons and study on your own, or a local representative will be happy to study with you, all completely free of charge. Visit www.BibleStudyOffer.com today.
We're back with Good Growing with the Garden Guy with Gary Heilig, Sue Majeur, and Tom Majeur. We're talking about GMO crops, genetically modified organisms. Gary, you've definitely run into a controversial subject, at least in some corners. Why are GMO crops made?
Well, let me give you an example from something that's actually being done right now. They have made a non-browning banana, and it's been approved in the United States, Canada, the Philippines, and Honduras. And basically what they've done is they've taken genes, and I don't know where that gene came from. I'd have to do some deeper digging. It may have come from another banana species. It might have come from another crop altogether. But the idea is to keep them from turning brown so fast, and also to be more resistant to bruising. And you could see where that would be useful in an industry standpoint, because if you have a banana that's going to be a little more resistant to bruising and it's not going to turn brown as fast, then you're likely to bring home that banana and be able to keep it a little bit longer. And they also have something they're working on. It's called drought-tolerant wheat. In other words, they've selected the genes that would allow the wheat to grow with the use of less water. And they're working on that. It has regulatory approval in Argentina, and they're not growing it widespread yet, but they're working on it. But the other things that you can do with gene editing, for instance, in the traditional way of breeding something, you would select out your two parent plants that had the characteristics that you like. So you might be a commercial farmer and or a commercial company, and you might have 100 acres of tomatoes. And one day you see that most of your tomatoes have a disease on it, but this one tomato doesn't have that much or little or no disease on it. Well, what they're going to do is cross that with some other trait that they want. It might be a trait that is resistant to bruising, it doesn't ripen as fast, or any number of different things that we might want to have, both from a commercial or a home use standpoint. And they would cross those, and then they would check the F1 or the progeny generation, and they'd see if those traits came through or not. And they keep doing these crosses until they got the plant that they wanted. That's what we call hybridization. But with genetic engineering, what they do is they can now do the genome of a plant, and they can find out what every little gene does in that plant. And then once they find out what is the gene that keeps this plant from getting this disease, they say, we want that gene. So what they do is they take that gene out and put it in the tomato plant that they want it in, like Brandywine, for instance, which is a really great old tomato, but it's very highly susceptible to disease. So you can keep all the qualities of Brandywine, flavor and all that sort of stuff. It's just more disease resistant. And that's one of the things that people, because it's not the traditional way of doing it, they feel a little bit concerned about it. But they also know that if the public won't accept it, all that research is a waste. So they have to get people to understand what they're actually doing. And now, they can't say that problems can't pop up if you start crossing genes between species, and that's where oversight by scientists and the government can keep people from doing crazy stuff. But it might be disease resistance. It might be delay the ripening, because there are certain crops that you can't ship because they just aren't shippable. They ripen too fast. Another thing, we talked in the past where over the years from the 1950s, our traditional breeding programs produced hybrids that had lower nutritional level than older varieties. And what they've done, as they've learned what is the mechanism for producing nutrients in plants, they can take those genes and put them in a plant that isn't very nutritious and make it more nutritious. The example was the golden rice that I told you about. And so it might also be to reduce the waste, like that's why they're doing the banana that doesn't brown so quickly. Some things don't have a long shelf life, like tomatoes or lettuce or potatoes. They don't last forever unless they're in an ideal storage conditions. But once they're on display in the store, they're no longer in ideal storage conditions. And certainly grocery stores would like some of this from a standpoint of cutting down on food waste, which also has an effect on the price of your food, because if you're losing, say, 10, 15% of it, then the rest of us are going to have to pay for that loss. So those are some examples. And there is a possibility that, we talked about this during the break, that maybe people might want to combine flavors. For instance, take the essence of banana flavoring and introduce it to strawberry, so you'd have like a strawberry banana flavor. Or you've heard of strawberry lemonade, peach lemonade, mango lemonade. You could introduce some of the aspects of those flavors, but flavor is not a simple thing, because the flavor that you detect in your mouth is a mixture of various sugars like glucose and fructose and various things like that. The acid level in the fruit, there are many volatile compounds. In other words, smell is intricately associated with flavor. If you don't believe me, eat something, anything, and then eat a piece of it again holding your nose, and you'll realize just how important those volatiles are in terms of you detecting flavor. And so you just can't simply put strawberry flavor. There are many different compounds that make up the flavor of various fruits. And so it'll be a very complicated process for them to figure out how to do something like that. But it's not impossible, and we may see that one day. Who knows? They might even create altogether new fruits, but we don't know.
Now, you know, as long as it's carefully regulated, I mean, like you say, sometimes the law is behind, you know, just because you can do something doesn't mean you should do it, you know, under some things. But other aspects are, like I said, if it's regulated, so it's not a bad thing. It's to benefit the people, first of all, and industry. I was thinking about a few years back where they were marketing these apples. They called them grapples. And they had supposed to be an apple with a grape flavor. And I wondered about that. I was like, is that some kind of weird cross? You know, thinking about like Plukots and Aperbum.
But I
found out that it was just they soaked the apples in this chemical, which horrified me, made me glad I never actually bought one. But that's not the same thing as what you're discussing for the GMO crops.
The chemical name for grape flavoring is methyl anthranilate, and that's basically what they're soaking them in, artificial grape flavoring.
Yeah.
But, well, if you ever drank Kool-Aid, that's what you were drinking. But the thing is,
makes me glad that mom didn't let us have that often.
Yeah, well, we liked it. We drank it sometime, but it wasn't healthy for you anyway, because it's mainly sugar. But it is possible to do that. And I remember listening to a program on NPR once, and this guy was it was really against genetic engineering, to the fact that he would commit crimes. He actually broke into a lab and some property and destroyed all these research crops. I think it was in England. And he ruined a lot of research, and that's to the extent that he went to keep this going. But then as he started studying it, he said he realized what they were actually doing, and he said as long as they are being watched to make sure that they're not doing things like introducing allergens into foods that didn't have that allergen before, he said this was going to be the way that we would feed the world, because it made agriculture more productive. And I think that if people understand the science behind genetically modified crops, then they're going to be less likely to be against them. But my attitude is always, people should have a choice. So I'm very much in favor of labeling, so that you know that something's genetically modified. But there are going to be more products coming down the line than less. But there'll always be a market for people who don't grow them like that, like organic, for instance. But you'll pay a premium price for that.
I think you helped us out a bit and just touched the surface about understanding and misunderstanding. You know, you've helped us in the past talking about hybrids. We've been, since the beginning of time, people have been doing hybrids all along. You have an interesting question here. Are crops developed by traditional methods also GMOs? And the answer
is yes, they are. And the reason I say that is because we have been messing with what was originally created. When you look at what corn was in the wild, it's nothing like it is now. You wouldn't have even paid any attention to it. Same thing with watermelon. Watermelons are nothing like what the original plant was. Now, you also have to remember, we talked about this a while back, that when man sinned, God cursed the ground, and it doesn't produce as well as it could have, and we've been playing catch-up through our breeding to try to make things better. And there are natural ways that we can improve things. For instance, you think about strawberries, and how sweet a strawberry is dependent upon its potential to produce sugars, because that varies between strawberries. Having the right weather, warm days and cool nights, makes a big difference. Fertilization makes a big difference. If you give strawberries too much nitrogen, it will affect their sweetness. And also, what commercial growers have started doing to increase the sugars in the plant is they will use what they call biostimulants and natural additives. And an example would be seaweed extract or certain amino acid sprays. And it will actually cause the strawberry or other crops to accumulate more sugar in that plant, and it increases the flavor intensity. So there are ways to improve plants without genetic engineering, but there's certain things that you just can't do without genetic engineering. It's impossible because there are these barriers between plants.
What is the up-and-coming thing that we might see?
Well, as I mentioned before, there's some apples. We're going to see more apple varieties that will not turn brown, and that's really nice in the restaurant business. Like, you think about somebody like McDonald's, where they would like to have healthier things, so they want to have apples, but they don't want them turning brown because nobody will eat them then. And so that's one of the things that they have started using, is apples that tend not to brown. Now, there are some naturally occurring apples, but they're going to be doing more and more of that in different varieties as time goes on. I think that most of the work will be to help things to resist pests, specifically diseases. Maybe not so much insects, because BT corn works really well, but there aren't a lot of those possibilities out there right now. there may be in the future, but we'll have to wait and see. But diseases are probably the biggest thing, because when you're trying to treat a disease, usually you have to be in a spray schedule of, say, 5 to 7 days during all the time that that disease can show up. And you might put 15 sprays on a crop to keep disease under control. Otherwise, the disease can end up on the edible part of the crop, and then, of course, it rots, and then nobody's happy. So that's where I think you're going to see most of the work done, is disease resistance over the years. And by them not having to spray so much, there'll be less chemicals to be concerned about. And also, it'll cut the cost, because spraying crops is not cheap. It is not cheap. I know that from personal experience. And so a farmer would be happy not to put these things on if they didn't have to.
So it all goes back to the thing about how we think of, we sell a product and we make a product, but for the farmer, the less stuff he has to buy or to do to his crop, the less it will cost him, and so he makes a profit out of what he doesn't spend instead of what he got paid for it.
Maybe.
Kind of.
May or may not get more of a profit, because prices will start to go down also, because he doesn't have to put so much into it. So, yeah, he might make a little bit more money, but also the prices will go down for the crop, which I don't think anybody would complain about.
Mm-hmm. No.
Well, why don't we take a break right now, and where you're listening to Good Growing with the Garden Guy. We'll be back after the break.
Hi folks, Jelaine Fenner here. We are definitely living in uncertain times, and for some of us, it's scary. Signs of the times are everywhere. Jesus is coming back soon. Read Revelation chapter 22. Jesus says, "Surely I am coming quickly." We at Strong Tower Radio have a free book for you called The Great Controversy. Go to the back of the book and read chapters 35 to 42. It'll help you understand the times we're living in and what's ahead. This book even has 800 historical quotes and 1,200 Bible quotes. I love this book. Call Strong Tower Radio today, 231-468-2087, and ask for The Great Controversy while supplies last. And if we don't answer, please leave a message asking for The Great Controversy with your name, address, and phone number. That's 231-468-2087. On Strong Tower Radio, where God's character is proclaimed.
We're back with Good Growing with the Garden Guy, Gary Heilig, Sue Majeure, and Tom Majeure. And here's your reminder. It's time to order those plants and seeds. With that in mind, you should wait till after this program, because you don't want to miss the last segment of Good Growing. But Gary, the third week of May is only about 70 days away. What's the big deal about 70 days?
Well, it just tells you how much time you have left to start your transplants. And so, as we talked about in February, you need to put together and you probably could find one online too, is a seeding calendar, or go to ChatGPT or some of the other ones and tell it, I am going to plant my garden around Memorial Day here in Michigan, mid-Michigan, and I need for you to give me a seeding chart as to when I need to seed all of my different vegetables. And then if you have specific flowers, you could also tell it what you should start. And then you would only have to do that once, because you could laminate that chart and you could use that as your seeding chart every year. And that's what we used to do in the greenhouse when I worked at the MSU greenhouses. We had a seeding chart for all those seeds that we started for the display gardens, for the All-America selections and vegetables and whatever we were going to grow. And each week we would check that seed chart of what we would be starting. And so people should do that too, because it's easy to forget or to start something a little late and it's not the size that you want it when it's time to put it in the garden.
You know, based on my experience, March 12 or March 19 is that target date that works out very good. And I start getting nervous if I get past March 19th to start seeding for my summer crops.
Yeah, I'll start pulling out stuff pretty soon. I've already started some things for the garden. The peppers are started in February. February. I try to get them done sometime in February, early part of the month. And also, as March starts to warm up, if somebody has strawberries, hopefully you mulched them during the winter, because if you didn't, especially if you have a higher clay content in your soil, you get frost heaving as you have the freezing and thawing cycles. And since strawberries are so shallow rooted, about 90% of them are in the top 6 inches, those roots will break, and it will affect how well they grow the next growing season if you haven't mulched them. But when we start getting into mid to late March, they'll start to break dormancy and they'll start to grow. So what I'll do is I'll pull back the mulch to see if I have new leaves growing and they're greening up. And if they are, then I'll leave the mulch back so they can get light and the soil starts to pick up heat. But if you're going to have a freeze at night, I'll just push it back over to give them a little bit of like a little blanket, because the soil will pick up heat during the day and then it will radiate the heat at night. But if you have something over it like your mulch, it will protect your plants a little better than just leaving them exposed day and night.
So tip number two is it's time to get your tiller and mower repairs, because the rush is coming very soon.
Yeah, if you can, get that done in February or even January if you can get it over to somebody. But, you know, things like changing the oil, like we said before, or if one year my headlight, I hit something and knocked out a headlight. The winter months or late winter months are a good time to get those things done. If you have to check the air pressure of the tires, or you might need to grease the machine. Otherwise, when you don't grease things, they tend to rub and they wear out a lot faster. So just general maintenance. And we talked about this in February, but usually you won't get it all done, because a lot of times in February, it's still a little chilly out in the garage unless you have a heater to get some of those things done. And then, of course, as we're moving into March and getting toward the end of March, just before bud break, the temperatures are getting up. And if you've had problems with, say, scale diseases on your apples, and an example of that would be you pick your apples and you have all these little red spots on them, especially on the bottom, that's San Jose scale, and they overwinter along with some other scale insects on the trunks of the trees. And they're pretty small, so unless you're using a hand lens or looking really close and you have good eyes, you would miss them. And when we're putting on dormant oils, we're putting them on when you have temperatures up around 40s during the day and you don't expect it to freeze for a couple of nights. So usually we're talking about later March and maybe even early April, depending on the year, because we can have some pretty warm Marches too. And you mix this up with water and you spray it on the whole plant, soak everything. And what it does is it covers up the scale with a very fine layer of highly processed oil, and it denies the scale oxygen and they suffocate. And then of course you can tell they're dead, because when you scrape them off, they're dry and crispy. A living scale, when you push on it, is kind of mushy. And that will help to eliminate those scale problems. And if you miss some, there's a second time that you can spray them, but it's during the growing season to get the new babies that are coming out. Because each unkilled, any scales that survive, the females can lay between 200 to 400 eggs. And they can build up again if you don't hit them really well. So you just have to watch the fruit, and when you start seeing the spots again, then you hit them with the dormant oil, and if you need to, you hit the immatures later on in the season. And you can tell when to spray for the young by going to MSU's website they have a site where you can look and see what's going on with fruits and vegetables and when different pests are coming out, and they tell you when you need to spray for those things. And it's also in the spray books that you can get too.
Does this tend to be just for tree fruits, or is it vegetables also?
Scale insects can be on other ornamentals also. And it may not be San Jose scale, but there's Lacanian scale. There are all different types of scale insects that are out there. And one of the indications that you might have a scale problem is, let's use magnolia scale as an example. The first thing people usually notice is if they have a tree large enough to have, say, lawn furniture or a little table or something under it, that table will start to get sticky. And it's sticky because the scale drops something called honeydew. That's their waste. And that gets all over everything, and it's sticky. And if it stays there long enough, then a sooty mold starts to grow on it. And it looks almost like soot has settled onto your furniture. And that's an indication that you have a scale insect in your tree. And that can also be treated in the spring before they start laying eggs. And again, you could just go online and ask one of the AIs and say, I live in mid-Michigan, I have Lacanium scale, or I have Magnolia scale, or whatever scale it is, and when is the best time to treat it? And it will tell you.
That's great.
That's the thing that people used to call us for.
You know, I've seen.
And now you can get that information from AI.
And what you described there on the furniture, I've literally seen that sooty scale, and I had no idea what was the cause of it.
Yeah, and if you have a willow tree, aphids also excrete honeydew, and so you can have that under a willow tree. There are a number of different trees that can get these things, but if you notice soot starting to build up on stuff under a tree, you can pretty well bet it's a scale insect that's doing it. Now, there are ways you could look at it. They're not likely to kill the tree, but another easy way to treat it is there is a product called imidacloprid, which is used for ash borer. And what you can do is mix this up in a 5-gallon jug or bucket, and then pour the material around the base of the tree, and it will be picked up by the root system, and it'll go throughout the leaves, and that's another way you can kill scale. If you have a large tree, it's kind of hard to use a sprayer, because anytime you're pointing your nozzle upward, it's going to blow back on you. So putting a soil drench down is much more effective.
What about perennial garden duties? What do we need to think about?
Well, if you're a good gardener that gets up to things, you probably would have already cleaned your garden out. But sometimes people don't, and so you have leftover dead material from the previous year. Some of it might be woody. Some of it might just be rotting things like leaves from hostas or whatever the case may be. And so before growth starts, you want to get all this stuff cut down, because it's much more difficult to do once it starts to grow. You have to be a lot more careful. So March is a really good time to get into that perennial garden and to cut down the stems and get all the leaves raked out, get any perennial weeds out that you can, and then put down a mulch so you won't have to weed constantly. And also in the spring is another time that you can divide perennials and move them to different locations if you want. You should do that before they start growing, or just as they're beginning to grow, you can still move a number of different things. So that's what you should do. Of course, it's probably a little bit early to plant perennial flowers, depending on how dry the soil is and what kind of soil you have. Most of the time, March is not good unless you have a dry spring and you're on a light sandy soil. But if you have kind of a wet clay, then probably April is a better time to plant. Now, fruit trees, you can get out there, and ornamental trees, you can get out there and plant as soon as you can dig, and you don't have the whole fill up with water.
What about soils and beds? What do we need to be doing there?
Well, one of the things I'm going to do in my raspberries, they're in a raised bed, and of course, over time, the soil will go down a little bit. And what I decided to do, I'm going to top dress that bed with finished compost that I've been making over the last year. So if you have compost that needs to be applied, if it's not too wet in late March, then you can put that on the surface, and then when you're ready to till the garden, just till it in. Or if it's in a raised bed, you can just top dress the bed, and you don't really have to work it in. Over time, worms will do that, and rain will work it in. And so it should be ready by late March, where you should be able to put the compost in the beds if you've done what you're supposed to have been doing in terms of turning it and all the things to help it to break down. Also in March, there are some vegetables that you can direct seed, like peas and spinach and lettuce and radishes, arugula. These things can take light frost, and if the soil can be worked, you can get those things into the garden and they'll be up and going. Also, if you've had a problem with slugs in the past, I've often mentioned that you want to catch them early in the spring before they have a chance to start mating and reproducing, and you also want to do it in the fall before they start to hide in their overwintering places. So March is a good time to put down your materials to kill them. I prefer to just use coffee grounds, but they have to be coffee grounds that have caffeine in them, not decaffeinated coffee grounds. They're very much attracted to it. You can just spread them all over the garden, and you don't have to worry about it anymore after that. And they'll feed on those things, and it will reduce their numbers. And if you want to do it for two straight months, like March and April, that's okay. You can even go again in May if you have a heavy infestation of slugs. And it will solve that problem. It works really well.
I think you.
And coffee is no problem for the soil.
I think you shared with me that somebody gave me some that they didn't want to use, but it hadn't been percolated. It has to. I think what you shared with me is it has to be, you know, the grounds have to have been boiled or brought to a temperature to extract the chemical that would affect this.
They eat the grounds. And there's caffeine in it. You don't have to do anything to it. You can use coffee grounds that have been used once. Like if you go to Starbucks or something and they want to give you extra coffee grounds, you can use the ones that have been used, but you can also use fresh.
Okay.
Most people that drink coffee don't want to do that because coffee's not cheap, but I don't drink coffee. And so if I want some, I'll just go buy a can and sprinkle it all over the garden. And you can use it in your perennial beds or any place where you're having problems with slugs.
All right.
So your hostas will thank you.
Yeah, it's a great place to use them. It does work. I've used it in the past.
What about...
The caffeine really, it actually kills them.
What about irrigation hoses and rain barrels?
Yeah, during the off times of the year or early in the spring, invariably if you have hoses, and I've done this a number of times, my wife does the hose repair, and I do the hose destruction because sometimes I might be mowing, and I mow a little bit too low, and I didn't see the hose there, and whack, and so we have to fix them every now and then. But that's the time to do that. Or if you sprung a leak in your drip hose, that's a real pain because you don't want the water spraying all over your plants because it'll wash off anything that you sprayed on your plants or leaving them wet in the evening and you get more diseases that way. So when we spring a leak, my wife will usually cut that section out and repair that section of the irrigation hose with the same thing that you use to repair hoses. And then, of course, once they get really bad, then we just toss them and get some new ones. But if you want to make them last longer, put them under your mulch so that they're not exposed directly to sunlight. So those things you want to get done. And I always tell people, be sure you get yourself a rain gauge to put in your garden so that you know how much annual or weekly rain you're getting. That helps to determine whether or not you need to water.
And purchase your fertilizers and plant boxes while they're still in good supply.
Yeah, I start getting those things now. And when the spring comes, all the farmers are buying their stuff. And I have gone to the elevator where they said, oh, we don't have a shipment in right now. It's going to be about two or three days. And so I prefer to go to the elevators and buy my fertilizer in 50-pound bags. Now, it's great to have that because it's a little less expensive than when you buy it by the 5-pound bags. And, of course, it depends on how large your garden is. But I will have some 10-10-10 or 6-24-24. I will usually have some organic fertilizers for certain things, too. So I start to gather all that stuff now, so that when spring comes, I'm not running around trying to get all these things together, because there's so many things to do in the spring. And I'm not getting any younger, so I try to spread these things out and get some of this stuff during the winter months.
Well, that wraps it up for March for Good Growing with the Garden Guy, Gary Heilig, Sue Majeure, and Tom Majeure. This is a service of Strong Tower Radio, where God's character is proclaimed. See you again next month. Bye.